WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm David Bean Cooley, filling in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, Presidential Courage, a talk with historian Michael Beschloss about the crucial moments when a president risked his political career for the good of the country, often taking an unpopular or controversial stand. It's the subject of his new book. We'll also hear some audio tape of FDR, Harry S. Truman, and JFK during some of those moments. Also, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews the new CD by the trio led by pianist Lafayette Gilchrist. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bean Cooley, TV critic for the New York Daily News, sitting in for Terry Gross. Presidential historian Michael Beschloss has written a new book, focusing on key moments in history involving nine different presidents. From George Washington to Ronald Reagan, Beschloss examines what he says were some of the most courageous and controversial decisions made by American presidents. Decisions so controversial, they could have threatened the future of their presidencies, but ultimately changed the future of the United States for the better. Beschloss's new book is called Presidential Courage, Brave Leaders and How They Changed America, 1789 to 1989. For his examination of several of the 20th century presidents included in his book, including Reagan, John F. Kennedy, and Harry Truman, Beschloss drew upon a lot of recently released material, including presidential diaries, notes, and secret tape recordings from the Oval Office. He also used taped interviews made after presidents had left office. We'll hear some of those recordings today. Beschloss is the author of eight previous books on American presidents, including two annotated collections of Lyndon Johnson's tapes. He is the presidential historian for NBC News and a contributor to PBS's The NewsHour with Jim Lehrer. Terry spoke with Michael Beschloss last week.
Michael Beschloss, welcome back to Fresh Air.
Thank you, Terry.
The first story I'd like you to talk about is Harry Truman, who the courageous moment you choose for him is his decision to recognize Israel in 1948. What was at stake for him? Why did it take such courage for him to do that?
Well, in the spring of 1948, the Jews who lived in Palestine were about to declare the State of Israel, and Truman was under huge pressure not to do it, especially by his Secretary of State, George Marshall, this very famous, heroic guy who many people in the United States admired, including Truman. But Marshall went to Truman and said, if you recognize Israel, I'm going to oppose you. And Truman was running for re-election that year. Had Marshall come out against him, that could have been curtains for Truman. On the other side, what I discovered was that Truman had a background with Jewish people that you really wouldn't expect from someone who was essentially a rural Missouri Baptist. One thing I discovered was that when he was a kid, he lived next to probably the only Jewish family in the town of Independence, Missouri, a family called the Viners. He was very close to the daughter, who was named Sarah. And it turned out that Truman worked for them as what they call a Shabbos goy, meaning that on the Jewish Sabbath, Truman, who obviously was not Jewish, performed chores that Jewish people were not able to do.
We actually have a tape you've brought with you of Truman talking about his decision to recognize Israel. And we're going to hear an excerpt of this. Would you introduce it to us? Tell us where this recording is from.
Sure. This is Truman in the early 1960s, so he would have been almost 80 years old. And what he's talking about is his memory of what he went through and how he got to this decision of recognizing Israel in 48.
So let's hear an excerpt of that tape of Harry Truman in the early 1960s.
No problem I faced while I was president of the United States was more controversial or more complex than the problem of Israel. In 1948, I was up to here in experts from the Army, the Navy, and the State Department. I had to take a look at myself for the simple reason I was trying to find out why a Midwest Baptist like me should get so emotionally upset over Palestine and the fate of the Jews and their terrible position in the world. I knew how they felt. My grandmother and my mother have told me many stories about what happened to the people who lived between Kansas and Missouri, how they were moved off their homes, as many goods and chattels as the federal soldiers thought they ought to have, loaded into a wagon and taken into town, where they had to stay all the time while the war was going on. I had some notion of what these people were going through who had to be moved from one place to another in order to have a home. And I was very anxious that they would not and should not have to go through the same sort of difficulties that the families in the war between the states had to go through. It was my attitude that the American government couldn't stand idly by while the victims of Hitler's madness were not allowed to build new lives. Hitler had been murdering Jews right and left. It's estimated that he killed 6 million Jews and burned most of them up in furnaces. It was a horrible thing. I saw it, and I dream about it even to this day. And on that account, the Jews needed some place where they could go. Some way had to be found to take care of those displaced persons, give them a place to live, something to eat, and something to wear. And it was up to us to try to get it done. We had just finished two wars, and we had a country of our own to put back on an even keel. I guess that's when I began to feel that the presidential chair was about the loneliest place that a man could be.
That's Harry Truman, recorded in the early 1960s. My guest is presidential historian Michael Beschloss, and his new book is called Presidential Courage. You know, listening to that, it sounds like Truman's dictating his memoirs.
Yeah, he was talking.
Or reading something that's already been written.
Yeah, like sort of the way that Truman talked, you know, because he thought that he should sound like a president, you know, not sound like really Harry Truman, who in many ways was a little bit more laid back. And there's another element in which that's true, Terry, because there are certain things he's not telling you. One of the things he's not telling you is that when he had to make this decision about recognizing Israel, he had to cope with his wife, Bess. And his wife, Bess, at best, was not very sympathetic. This is a woman who, as Truman said late in life, did not allow Jewish people into her house. She was someone who was from what was considered to be a patrician family and independence, and she used to say that she didn't feel that Jewish people were really her sort. So you've got a president who, as you heard, is sympathetic to Jewish people, but at the same time, he's got to go home at night to a wife who will not even let Jewish people through the front door.
What were some of the other pressures that were on him? Because he had complained about pressures from Zionists and Jews.
Another one was that, as you can imagine, during the years before 1948, a lot of Americans, many of them Jewish, were very passionate about the idea that you should take these Holocaust refugees and give them a homeland, that that's the only way to make sure that Jewish people will never again have to suffer from another Adolf Hitler. And they were very determined. One was Rabbi Hillel Selver, who went to Truman's office, the Oval Office, in 1946, and actually pounded on Truman's desk saying, "You must recognize a Jewish state." And Truman was so angry that he said, "From now on, I don't want any Jewish leaders in my office." And so it was.
Later in the tape that you brought, he talks about actually allowing an Israeli leader into his office. Do you want to tell us the story?
That's exactly right. You know, at the same time as he's angry at all these Zionist leaders, and I found, for instance, a piece of his diary that was lost for years, in which he says things like, you know, the Jews are very selfish, they're only campaigning for their own people, and they don't care what happens to other people. And he said at one point, "Jesus Christ couldn't please the Jews while on earth, why did I think that I would have any luck?" Things that almost verge on anti-Semitism. At the same time, he was torn. And what happened was that this ban on Jewish leaders coming to his Oval Office included Chaim Weizmann, who was ultimately the first president of Israel, very determined to get a Jewish state. Weizmann wanted to come and see Truman and say, "You know, you must listen to our case. You know, don't slam the door just because you're angry at this one rabbi." Truman wouldn't see him. And so finally what happened was Truman had a very good friend who was in the army with him named Eddie Jacobson, who was Jewish. They actually ran a canteen together when they were in the army in World War I. After that, they ran this famous haberdashery store in Kansas City that went bankrupt, yet the two men stayed very close. Finally, Jacobson said, "If you won't see these Zionist leaders, at least see me." So he came to see him, and he said, "Harry, this doesn't sound like you." And tears were rolling down Jacobson's cheeks. He said, "Why blame the people who want a Jewish state just because you're angry at a rabbi? You really should see Chaim Weizmann, at least hear him out." And so he did.
So Truman decides to recognize Israel. Are there consequences that he faces as a result?
Big consequences, because, needless to say, a lot of people who wanted Israel were delighted to see him do it. But Secretary of State George Marshall, there was an open question whether he might get angry and resign, and also that a lot of people might be suspicious of Truman and say, well, perhaps he did this just for political reasons. And the interesting thing about Truman is that he was always torn. But what finally dominated his thinking was, you know, yes, I think there should be a Jewish state. And since he was a kid, he read the Bible and he was a Baptist, but he knew a lot about history. He knew how historically important it would be for him to regather Jewish people in Zion. His favorite Bible passage was the line, "We wept when we remembered Zion." And later in life, having gone through all this, he won the 48 election. it was the thing that he was almost most proud of. And Eddie Jacobson, just after Truman was president, introduced Truman at a big gathering and said, "This is the man who helped the State of Israel be established." And Truman said, "What do you mean, help get established? I'm Cyrus." And what he was referring to was the ancient Persian king he had read about when he was a king who allowed the Jewish people to go to Babylon.
Michael Beschloss speaking to Terry Gross. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, we're listening to an interview Terry Gross recorded with presidential historian Michael Beschloss about his new book, Presidential Courage, Brave Leaders and How They Changed America. Beschloss brought along several presidential tape recordings he relied upon as part of his research for the book, including tapes from the Kennedy administration.
Michael Beschloss, you choose as President Kennedy's moment of courage is his decision to back civil rights and civil rights legislation, which was not a decision he immediately made. Why did you choose this as his example of courage?
Well, what I'm trying to do with all these nine presidents is talk about the fact that none of them was a saint. All of them wanted, at times, to do the wrong thing. They wanted to escape something that might be akin to political suicide, and a lot of them waited. And no better example of John Kennedy. He was elected in 1960 with 90% of the African-American vote, promising to do things for civil rights. Yet, when he became president, he did almost nothing. And the reason was that in 1960 he was elected mainly because he carried the white South. He didn't want to lose it when he ran for re-election in 1964. So what happened was that Martin Luther King, the great civil rights leader of that time and all time, was saying, you know, the Kennedys really have foiled us. You know, they promised us they would do things. They're not doing them. So King was going to places in the South and trying to create pressure that would go against the Kennedys and say, if you do not act, there will be big, bad consequences for you. One of those places was 1961 in Alabama.
So tell us who Bobby Kennedy is talking to and what the occasion for the discussion is.
This is Bobby Kennedy a year after his brother's death. He's very depressed, as you'll hear. He's talking to Anthony Lewis, the New York Times man. This is a tape that's never been heard publicly before, about his brother and civil rights. And he's describing Martin Luther King's anger in 1961 that the Kennedys were not doing more to protect King and also protect other demonstrators for civil rights who were down in the South.
Okay, so here's the tape.
Sunday night. And Martin Luther King was concerned about whether he was going to live and whether his people were going to live. And I was concerned about whether the place was going to be burned down. He kept getting these reports that the crowds were moving in and that they were going to burn the church down and shoot the Negroes as they ran out of the church.
He did burn a car right in front of the church.
What was Governor Patterson saying on the phone?
Well, first on Martin Luther King, I said that our people were down there, and that as long as he was in church, he might say a prayer for us. He didn't think that that was very humorous, and he rather berated me for was happening to him at the time, and I said to him that I didn't think he'd be alive if it wasn't for us, and that we were going to keep him alive.
That's an excerpt of a tape from Bobby Kennedy speaking about a phone conversation he had in 1961 with Martin Luther King at a time when King felt that President Kennedy wasn't doing enough to support him or the larger civil rights movement. And my guest is Michael Beschloss, who has brought several historical tapes with him, and we're talking about his new book, Presidential Courage. So how did President Kennedy decide to actually support civil rights legislation and try to push it through Congress?
What finally happened was that, you know, you heard Bobby saying King berated him. King kept on berating the president, and he kept on creating situations that put pressure on JFK. And finally, in the spring of 1963, there were demonstrations in Birmingham, Alabama, which went into riots. And John Kennedy basically was confronted with a real choice. Do I continue to do nothing about civil rights? And Bobby told him, if you do that, the northern cities of the United States in 1963, this summer, may go up in flames and everyone, white and black, is going to blame the president. Or do you send a big civil rights bill to Congress that says everyone, no matter what their race, can use all hotels and restaurants? Kennedy finally did that, but he was very worried. And even after sending that bill to the Hill, he said, you know, this really may destroy me. This may cost me my reelection. But then he said to Bobby, you know, if we're going to go down, let's go down for something as important as civil rights.
And one of the things he was afraid of regarding going down is that he'd lose the support of the Southern vote.
Absolutely, and he did almost instantly. The polls found that he dropped in the South about 25 points, and the irony is that had John Kennedy lived and run for president again in 1964, he might have lost because the white South was furious at him. He would have lost those Southern states.
Well, you brought a tape with you of President Kennedy speaking on the phone in 1963, spring of 1963, with Louisiana Senator Russell Long. And Long is angry about Kennedy's support of civil rights. What are Louisiana and other Southern states threatening to do here that Kennedy's trying to stop in this phone conversation?
They are threatening to field an anti-civil rights slate of electors for the Electoral College in the presidential election of 1964 against Kennedy. So the idea is that if those slates win across the South, they can throw the presidential election into the House of Representatives, and they can go to Kennedy and his Republican opponent in 1964 and say, we're going to give our votes and give the presidency to that person who will be the most against civil rights. Kennedy's trying to head that off.
Okay, well, let's hear this 1963 conversation.
Well, that's terrific.
Well, thanks so much, Mr. President.
How are you doing? I hear we're in some trouble in Louisiana.
Well, sir, I haven't had a chance to check today. I was down in, I went to Houston, Texas, to kind of see if I could squeeze a little money out of the oil people to get us along. And I talked to the governor of Louisiana from over there, and he said that he thought he might be able to keep that bill in that House.
The thing is, what's so screwy about that thing is that if a Democrat carries Louisiana, no matter who those delegates are, they can't go up and make a deal with a Republican then, let's say, because the Republican can't look like he's in the position of outbidding a Democrat on some civil right question. So therefore, the best they could do is throw it in the House of Representatives, and then everybody gets sort of on the hot seat, because then either you break up the Democratic Party or everybody votes Democratic. So where does it end? I know it's sort of just a means of protest, isn't it?
Well, no, what they've got in mind, they're trying to work out a sort of a block vote type deal where they would get their votes together and,
yeah,
and then say, all right, now, if our vote might elect somebody president,
yeah,
and he's going to have to come to our terms. Now, you know, those fellows made some kind of a deal like that in that Tilden Hayes race, I believe it was.
Yeah, that's right, I know.
And
but this isn't 1870.
Oh, I agree.
I think it isn't 1876.
I think it's a lousy idea.
Because what happens is, I mean, it will become the most publicized thing. Then they come up and say, well, you've got to do something. You know, first place, you've got the courts operating anyway, no matter what the president did.
Right.
And then they come up, and then everybody's looking and saying, well, what is the president promising this group? And pretty soon, you've got the god finally ends up in the House of Representatives. And it doesn't get him much. In addition, everybody then says, Christ, the South is so uncertain that I better just try to get my votes in the North.
That's right. Well, of course, the worst thing about that, I don't know who you thought about it, but with the bill that they've got, I haven't studied, but I've been told about it. You see, the worst thing about that is that, in effect, that would take the South out of the presidential election.
Exactly.
So that if we were not going to vote on whether you were going to be president or not, why should you promise us anything?
Exactly.
You should direct your appeal to those
people.
The Negro vote might be the key vote.
And at least I could count on it. Otherwise, I'd have to figure, well, I have to do my business after November, and I can't do it under those conditions. I think it's crazy for the South, because this way I'm concerned about Georgia and Louisiana and these places where we got a chance to carry. But if I end up with no chance to carry them, then I got to go up north and try to do my business.
Right. Well, now, I'll tell you,
that's President Kennedy and Louisiana Senator Russell Long, recorded in 1963. Michael Beschloss, what does President Kennedy mean when he says he'd have to take his business up north?
What he means by that is that he's going to have to start going to the right again and saying, well, maybe I'm not so much for civil rights after all. And Kennedy was this very mixed person in the 1950s. He was probably the most anti-civil rights candidate of those potential candidates for 1960, to the point that he was once at a banquet with the great African-American baseball player Jackie Robinson, who was so angry at Kennedy's stance that Robinson wouldn't even have his picture taken with Kennedy.
When President Kennedy says to Senator Long that if the Southern states go through with their threat, then Kennedy will have to go north and do his business there, what does that mean?
What Kennedy is saying to Long is, if you're going to shut me out of the South in the election of 1964, then I'm going to have to go really liberal and try to get a lot of northern votes to counteract this.
And the South wouldn't like that.
South would not like that at all, especially on civil rights.
So what was the outcome of this conversation? Did Louisiana and the other southern states back down?
In the end, they did. There wasn't a slate like that because, as it happened after Kennedy was assassinated, Barry Goldwater ran in 1964, and he was against civil rights. But Kennedy couldn't know that, and up to the moment he was murdered, he feared that he was going to be done out of the 1964 election because of this ruse.
Michael Beschloss, speaking to Terry Gross. We'll hear more of their conversation in the second half of the show. I'm David Bianculli, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from Dial Press Trade Paperbacks, publisher of Cellophane, a novel set in the heart of the Amazon rainforest by Marie Arana, author of American Chica. From the Horace W. Goldsmith Foundation, supporting the Museum of Modern Art in Midtown Manhattan. Information at moma.org. And from 20th Century Fox Home Entertainment, presenting The Seven Spiritual Laws of Success, based on the book by doctor and scholar Deepak Chopra, now on DVD. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, Kevin Whitehead reviews the new recording by the Lafayette Gilchrist Trio. We're listening to it now. And we continue our interview with presidential historian Michael Beschloss and hear some of the crucial moments following the assassination attempt on President Reagan. This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, sitting in for Terry Gross. Let's get back to Terry's interview with presidential historian Michael Beschloss about his new book, Presidential Courage, Brave Leaders and How They Changed America. In the book, Beschloss chose some of the most courageous and controversial decisions made by 9 different American presidents, decisions that ultimately changed the U.S. for the better. He used recently released material, including presidential recordings, for his book. When we left off, they were talking about John Kennedy's decision to support civil rights legislation.
You have another tape you've brought with you, and this is recorded during the period when President Kennedy is trying to get his civil rights bill through the House of Representatives. He's on the phone with Mayor Daley of Chicago. What's happening in this conversation?
Well, coming from Chicago, I can particularly tell you he's calling up Daley, who was the boss of Chicago, you know, very powerful influence over all the members of Congress from Chicago, and saying, you've got this congressman from Chicago named Roland Libonati. He's against my civil rights bill. Libonati was from a district in Chicago, very anti-African-American district, very worried about civil rights. He was feeling the pressure. So Kennedy is calling up Daley and saying, can't you get this guy into line? And you'll hear what Daley says.
With that Judiciary Committee trying to get this civil rights together, and Roland Libonati is sticking it right up us.
Is he? Here?
Yeah, because he's standing with the extreme liberals who are going to end up with no bill at all. Then when we put together, he's going to vote for the extreme bill. And I asked him if he'll vote for this package, which we've got together with the Republicans, which gives us about everything we wanted, and he says no.
He'll vote for it. He'll vote for any guy that you want.
Well, can you get him?
I surely can. Where is he? Is
he's there? In the other room.
Well, you have Kenny. Tell Kenny to put him on the wire here.
How did you get? Where are these tapes from, and how were they recorded?
In this case, this is a tape that Kennedy made himself of many of his telephone calls, and these were some of the things I used in my research. He also taped a lot of meetings. Some of them have only been opened in recent years.
And did the people on the other end know they were being taped?
They didn't, and as a very strong believer in civil liberties, I think that's horrible because you're trapping someone, you know, forever putting his or her words on tape without that person knowing that he or she is being trapped. But since it was done, I must say, as an historian, it's an absolute gold mine, and I couldn't have written these stories really without them.
Are the tapes technically illegal because the person on the other end didn't know they were being recorded?
Nowadays, they would be illegal in a lot of states, but in those days, this was very early in the technology, so much less so.
And this might sound like a silly question, but did President Kennedy ever try to use these tapes to pressure or blackmail anybody?
Not to my knowledge, but there was always the possibility that that might be the case. Lyndon Johnson often did. You know, he once said that the reason he taped was to make sure if some senator made him a promise and reneged, he could go back to him and say, this is what you promised me, and give almost a direct quote.
Now, Kennedy was assassinated before the Civil Rights Bill passed. It passed under President Johnson. Had Kennedy lived, do you think he would have succeeded in getting through the Civil Rights Bill?
Would have had a much harder time, because one reason LBJ was able to get that civil rights bill, which was still tremendously controversial through the House and Senate, was he said, you may have some qualms about this, senators, especially in the South, but do it as a memorial to our great President Kennedy. This is what he wanted. So the irony is that when John Kennedy died in Dallas, he ended up being essentially the person who allowed civil rights to come to America. Jackie Kennedy, just after John Kennedy was killed, was told the assassin is what she called the silly little communist, Lee Harvey Oswald, and she was so bitter about it. She said it had to be a silly little communist who killed Jack. He didn't even have the satisfaction of being killed for civil rights, but in a way, finally, he was.
There's another tape you brought with you that I wanted you to play for us, and this is a tape right after the assassination attempt on President Reagan's life. And this is recorded in the Situation Room. It's a secret top-level meeting about the possibility that Soviets were involved in the attempted assassination. And the people in the room were discussing responding to the assassination attempt by raising the alert level. Who's speaking here?
You'll hear the voices of Alexander Haig, who was the Secretary of State, Caspar Weinberger, who was the Defense Secretary, and others. And the second they heard that Reagan had been shot, which was really only a few minutes earlier, their first thought was it must be the Russians, because Reagan is so anti-Soviet, the Russians probably wanted Reagan dead so they could deal with his vice president, George H.W. Bush 41, because he'd be easier to deal with. So what they're talking about is the possibility that the Soviets may have just assassinated the president, and they've got to respond with a military alert.
Now, what is being said is a little hard to make out. But I want to say before we hear this, what I find most remarkable about this tape is how low-key it is. You know, we've all seen the Hollywood movie where there's, like, you know, an attempt on the president's life or something, and behind the scenes there's the secret meeting, and everything's at this, like, fever pitch, and it's really high drama. And this is just, like, just sound-wise, sonically, it's the opposite of that.
Yeah, it ain't exactly like that movie Air Force One. And I think the best explanation maybe is that they're all a little bit confused and trying to stay calm, because who knows what may be next, maybe even a Soviet attack.
Well, this is that recording in a secret meeting after the assassination attempt on President Reagan's life.
Okay. Yeah, I have the chairman of the Joint Chiefs coming on, Jones, now in just a second. And I'm going to tell him to get alerts to the Strategic Air Command and such other units as seem to him to be desirable at this point. Not to come up here, but
kind of an alert, Cap?
That's a standby alert. Just a standby alert.
You're not raising, ready?
No. Also, but the main thing is that he should stay there in the command center, not here.
Right.
There.
Al, don't elevate it. Be careful.
Absolutely. That's why I toned down the message of going out.
Yeah, I don't think anything that talks
There's
about
no
the
reason for
continuity
that.
Of the government or anything. That sounds like we know a lot more than we knew.
Yeah. Exactly.
This is apt to turn out to be a loma.
I think it was. Yep. Yeah.
Cap, what do they mean by alert?
Well, an alert is that
we've been down this path once before.
Yeah,
with Henry. Yeah.
That's right. The alert simply is that there are conditions which may require very
you
quick
sure that
action.
Doesn't mean DEFCON 3 or
no,
4 to
no.
Them?
I'll tell him it's a matter of being ready for some later call. It's probably DEFCON 2, I guess.
Well,
yeah, I think the important thing, fellas, is that these things always generate a lot of dope stories, and everybody's running around telling everybody everything that they can get out of their gut. And I think it's goddamn important that none of that happens. That the president, as long as he's conscious and can function,
That's right. That the vice president's, in an Air Force
just
plane.
Just point out to you that the president is not now. Conscious.
No, of course not.
And,
question
now, so
should you talk to the Speaker of the House?
Yes.
The Speaker of the House.
That's an amazing tape. I hope our listeners could make some of that out. They're talking there about, well, is the president conscious? No, he's not conscious. Well, should we alert the Speaker of the House, who's next in line of succession, to stand by? And so it's all very low-key sounding, but it's incredible stuff they're saying. And, you know, of course, they're also talking about raising the level of alert and fearing that there's a Soviet threat behind the shooting of the president. Did the public know this at the time?
No, and they tried very much to make sure the public did not know how much they were worried, because their general thought was that if there's going to be an attack by the Soviet Union, and the Soviet Union and the U.S., largely because of Reagan at that moment, could not have been more opposed and antagonistic. If there was a Soviet attack, they always felt that it would start with an attack, an assassination attempt on the chief of government, the president. That's what they thought this might be.
How did you get this tape? Where is this tape from? How was it made?
This was actually made by a guy called Richard Allen, who was Reagan's first national security advisor. He just had a little tape machine in the room because he thought that moment might be historic, as of course it turned out to be. This is a moment that really led to a turning point, because one of the things I also used in writing these stories was Ronald Reagan's private diaries. And in the diaries he says, you know, the assassination attempt has taught me something, and that is that God spared me for a purpose. I must be here on earth for something. And maybe what that is trying to bring peace to the world and trying to create a better relationship with the Soviets and abolish nuclear weapons. And so from that moment on, Reagan was thinking, how can I do that? And what finally happened was history was changed by two women. One was his wife, Nancy, who in 1984 said, Ronnie, this showdown of yours with the Soviets is getting ridiculous and dangerous. You've got to change. And Nancy brought in a woman whose name is not well known, a woman called Suzanne Massey, who was a little bit mysterious. She was someone who had written on Russian culture. She came in and saw Reagan probably 3 or 4 dozen times throughout the rest of his presidency. She reminded him of his mother. And she said, you know, yes, the Soviets are dangerous, but they're also human beings that you can relate to. That led directly to his decision to try to relate to Mikhail Gorbachev.
And that decision to work with Gorbachev to try to end the Cold War is the decision that you use as President Reagan's example of presidential courage.
That's it, because a lot of the people who loved Reagan and had backed him for years, what they liked about him was that this is a guy who was tough on the Soviet Union. As far as they were concerned, he would be that way forever. So in 1986, when he says, Gorbachev is for real, I think he's really trying to seek peace, I'm going to try to work with him. A lot of people said to Reagan, who had supported him for years, we're finished with you. We think that you're a sentimental idiot. Who have you been listening to? And as it turns out, now we can know, because you get this information that was behind the scenes, the people who he was listening to were largely women, his wife and Suzanne Massie. And that sort of fits because in the 1980s, a lot of the people in the United States who were most worried about Reagan doing things that might lead to a war with the Soviet Union were women.
Who were some of the hardliners within Reagan's own administration who were opposed to his working with Gorbachev?
There were people who, in fact, even earlier, someone like Alexander Haig, whom Reagan fired in part in 1982 because he was so tough. There were people on his national security staff. But largely the people who were worried about this were people who had been his political supporters for years. You know, people who did direct mail and who had campaigned for him really back to the beginning of his career in 1966. Reagan, for his part, had always been very honest. He'd said, I think the way to make peace with the Soviets is to challenge them and put the pressure on them so they'll see that they can never win the Cold War. But once they do that, and once a leader tries to seek peace, I'll respond to that. His old backers didn't really listen to the second part of the sentence. So when Gorbachev came and Reagan thought he was for real and Reagan started to deal with him, these people said, you know, we think that this Ronald Reagan is not the person we thought he was.
You mentioned that President Reagan kept a handwritten diary almost every day of his presidency. And excerpts of those diaries are going to be published soon. Do you consider those diaries to be forthcoming, or are they the kind of things you make available to the public because you know the diary is going to be public, but you don't necessarily put in what's really going on behind the scenes?
They give you some glimpses, and they're very useful in understanding Reagan at certain points. But this is someone who, as you know, Terry, was the opposite of introspective or reflective. And even Nancy Reagan has said, you know, even I could not get beyond that barrier, that Ronnie was someone who was so hurt by his first wife walking out on him or the end of his film career after World War II, other hurts in life, an alcoholic father, that this is someone who was really very self-contained and oftentimes never confided even to Nancy, with whom he had this famously close marriage, what he was really thinking.
Michael Beschloss speaking to Terry Gross. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's interview with presidential historian Michael Beschloss. His new book examines crucial and brave decisions by nine U.S. presidents.
You have done so much with presidential tapes over the years in your various books and CDs and so on, and you've drawn on presidential tapes for your new book, Presidential Courage. So you're very sensitive to the historical value of the documents that presidents and their administrations leave behind. So I'm really interested in what you have to say about the Karl Rove email story. And this is the story where he kind of created an alternate channel for his emails so that they wouldn't be part of the official White House administration historical documents that would be open to the public. He had an alternate channel through the Republican National Committee. And their emails are not part of that open. they're not open documents.
Right.
And I guess he erased those emails too. And now there are attempts to try to restore them. Would you talk about what the laws are about the official White House communications that are supposed to be eventually open to the public for historical reasons?
It's absolutely horrible, Terry, because what the law says is that presidents have to make very careful records and keep them and put them in libraries. They have to, for instance, preserve their hard drives. But what really happens, and has been happening in recent years, George W. Bush's administration more than anyone else, is an effort to make sure that this kind of stuff is not left for later historians and maybe even contemporary prosecutors. What the White House counsel will now tell a president is, you know, don't make, certainly don't make tapes because you know, it's an entrapment to the people who don't know about them, but also don't write diaries, don't write letters, don't keep really careful memos because they might be leaked, they might get to some kind of a prosecutor if there's a scandal. And so the result is, and we're seeing it in just what you're talking about, is we in the future will not have the kind of records of a contemporary president. As you know, in this book, I write about earlier presidents from George Washington and John Adams all the way through Abraham Lincoln and Theodore Roosevelt, and also Franklin Roosevelt. And in writing these stories about all those guys and trying to get into their marriages and into their brains and how they got through these ordeals, what I had were these wonderful diaries and these letters and public documents, official documents that were preserved. Sometimes they were closed for 50, 75 years because they were explosive or sensitive. That's the kind of thing that you really need to not only write about a president going through an ordeal that requires courage, but also to get into his mind, to understand what his relationship with his wife was or with his mother, you know, what his temperament was. And if this paper trail begins to dry up, as it's now doing for presidents, we historians in the future are going to have a very hard time.
What was the most exciting discovery in terms of, you know, audio or paper documents that you found while researching your new book?
In Franklin Roosevelt's case, this is someone who, not by current standards, but really did try to manage his image. Wanted people to think that this was someone who was just a fine, noble person always. And I found two tapes that were actually sort of an exception. Roosevelt in 1940 started making tapes for a while of some of his conversations in the Oval Office and accidentally recorded one conversation in which he's telling one of his campaign managers to spread dirty stories about his opponent in the 1940 election, Wendell Willkie. He's saying, I hear Willkie has a mistress. Of course, I can't say this in a speech, but why don't you get people to spread the story about so that it hurts Willkie? And also, he was trying to spread a story that Willkie had been very unkind to his father, who drank too much and had him buried in the potter's field when the father died. This is just the kind of thing that Roosevelt would have been furious to know had been preserved on tape so that people like me could hear it.
So how was it preserved?
In this case, Roosevelt began taping some of his conversations in the Oval Office in the fall of 1940, but figured he'd weed out the ones that were ones that didn't show him in a very good light. These are a few that he missed weeding out.
Well, why don't we close with an example of the kind of tape you're talking about, and this is FDR talking about this whisper campaign that he's helping to instigate against his Republican opponent, Wendell Willkie. Now, because this tape of Roosevelt is a little hard to make out, Michael Beschloss, I'd like you to basically tell us exactly what we're going to hear, and then we'll be able to understand it better as we listen.
Okay, I'll try not to do my FDR impersonation, but what he's saying is that Mrs. Willkie has been perhaps not hired, but in effect she's been hired to make this campaign with Wendell. Whether there is a money price involved or not, I don't know, but it's the same idea, he says.
And FDR is talking to a campaign aide here, trying to convince his campaign aide to spread this information?
Right. He's caught essentially with his pants down, FDR is. It's the kind of thing he would have been mortified to know that here we are playing and listening to.
So we'll close with this President Roosevelt tape. And Michael Beschloss, I want to thank you so much for talking with us and for sharing some of these tapes with us. Thank you.
Thank you, Terry. I always love being with you.
Now, Mrs. Willkie may not have been hired, but in effect she's been hired to return to Wendell and smile and make this campaign with him. Now, whether it was a money price behind it, I don't know, but it's the same idea.
Presidential historian Michael Beschloss speaking to Terry Gross. His new book is called Presidential Courage, Brave Leaders and How They Changed America, 1789 to 1989. Coming up, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead on the new CD featuring pianist Lafayette Gilchrist. This is Fresh Air. Thank you. Washington-born pianist Lafayette Gilchrist has been touring with saxophonist David Murray for the last 7 years. When he's off the road and at home in Baltimore, he leads a 7-piece band called the New Volcanoes. But his new album showcases his piano in a trio setting. But, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead says, this isn't a typical trio.
Great jazz pianists are often admired for their restraint. Count Basie, Thelonious Monk, Paul Bley, Herbie Hancock, and others showed how to do more with less, each in their way. Still, some fine pianists do more with more, like Lafayette Gilchrist. The way he gets the whole piano vibrating puts him in a long line of jazz maximalists, going back to the ragtime, boogie-woogie, and stride pianists with their two-handed polyrhythms and lines voiced in ringing octaves. Gilchrist's forebears also include McCoy Tyner with his thundering tremolos and South Africa's Abdullah Ibrahim, who can make piano sound like a drum choir. The idea is not to play fast, but to cover a lot of ground and make the box shout. The main thing that separates Gilchrist's trio from other jazz piano combos is his rhythm section. In most trios, the drummer articulates loose swing time on the cymbals while an upright bassist walks tuneful lines 4 beats to the bar. But on the new Lafayette Gilchrist 3 from the Hyena label, drummer Nate Reynolds lays down fat funk beats on snare and hi-hat for a tight clipped sound, and Anthony Blue Jenkins on bass guitar plays popping riffs and slabby sub-basement low tones. This is jazz from people who grew up listening to hip-hop, P-funk, and Washington go-go music. But the basic idea is jazz 101. Every player articulates a different aspect of the groove to layer and energize the rhythm. Lafayette Gilchrist has been making records with his mid-size band, the New Volcanoes, since the 90s. But he plays so much piano, he barely needs trumpets and saxes to fill out his sound. Besides which, the blunt, close horn voicings he writes seem lifted straight off the keyboard, as if he's orchestrating what he might play himself. At the piano, he thinks in terms of multiple lines. He might set up a right-hand rhythm in conflict with his left, so we get 4 layers from 3 players. Gilchrist's music can be a little heavy, but in his hands, that's not a big problem. Some musicians get all heavy because they don't have the sense to rein themselves in. Lafayette Gilchrist sounds like he has so much music in him, he's just gotta let it out.
Kevin Whitehead teaches English and American Studies at the University of Kansas, and he's a jazz columnist for eMusic.com. He reviewed Lafayette Gilchrist 3 on the Hyena label. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Patty Leswing, Ian Chillog, Sam Brigger, Jonathan Menhivar, and Joan Tui Westman. For Terry Gross, I'm David Bianculli.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of the Barnes & Noble Classics edition of Villette, Charlotte Bronte's last novel, in stores and online at bn.com. From 20th Century Fox Home Entertainment, presenting The Seven Spiritual Laws of Success, based on the book by doctor and scholar Deepak Chopra, now on DVD. And from Audible.com, where you can download and listen to Fresh Air, in addition to audiobooks, magazines, and newspapers. Audible.com/Fresh Air. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Jack Fertel, artistic director of the New York City Center Encore Series, one of New York's hottest tickets for musical theater fans. Their new production, starring Kristen Chenoweth, takes material from many classic Broadway reviews. Join us for the next Fresh Air.